Just last month, in July of 2025, an announcement was made that shook up the predetermined beliefs of many a historian. Michael S. Baron, a graduate student in Israel Studies and Archaeology, claims to have translated the inscriptions inside the mines at Sarabit El Kadim. And in these translations, he believes that he has the oldest known references to the biblical figure of Moses. Take that a step further. He believes that some of these inscriptions were actually potentially made by Moses himself. Now that's quite a claim, one that challenges both Bible believers and skeptics alike to, you know, actually look at the evidence instead of just saying, of course, I know what it is. So let's take a look at the evidence. All right. Hi, my name's Dan and welcome to the Dunking. In the winter of 1904 and 1905, Sir Flinders Petrie was exploring Sarabit El Kadim, and inside the copper and turquoise mines, the ancient copper and turquoise mines, mind you, he found these inscriptions that were unlike anything that had ever been seen before. Known as proto-Sinaitic, this is a strange mixture of Egyptian hieroglyphs and an actual phonetic alphabet. And this odd writing appears in several places inside the mines, and it's been cataloged, and casts are made of many of them, but actually translating the writing has thus far eluded anyone that's tried. And this is where Michael S. Baron's claims are particularly interesting. He not only says that he's translated the script, but he has two noteworthy statements. A saying of Moses, and this is of Moses. And this implies that this was written at the time of Moses. And he believes that the one that says this is of Moses quite possibly was made by Moses himself. Sinai 357 and 361 is the official designation for each of these inscriptions, and both of them contain what Baron believes to be MS, the name for Moses in the ancient Semitic language. Now, Baron has done a complete investigation of all these inscriptions, so detailed, in fact, he's identified different writers and which ones were made by the same authors. According to Michael S. Baron, anyway, I mean, of course, there's skeptics and critics. Most notably would be Michael Schneider, another Egyptologist. And he says, you know, you can't really say for certain yet, and we don't want to really grab a translation that we don't know anything about and just run with it. That's dangerous. And, you know, these seem sensible, you know, criticisms for him to make on its surface. But what's interesting is if you look at Michael Schneider's work, you can see quickly why he actually has a problem with this. He believes that the ancient Egyptian and Semitic idea of the word Moses, he thinks that they've got the translation screwed up a little bit. I'll read from his paper so that I don't screw it all up with my blue-collar speak. Moses scholarship has long held that the name Moses is one of the irreducible elements of the Moses narrative and would be an essential link in the Exodus tradition if it is indeed derived from the Egyptian root M-S-Y, to be born. This article reassesses the long-held Egyptian etymology of the name Moses, constituting the first comprehensive treatment of the question since J.G. Griffin's 1953 article, The Egyptian Derivation of the Name Moses, Journal of Near Eastern Studies. This contribution adds to the debate an evaluation of the name's vocalization, which is a major, hitherto unknown, problem, and discusses the ancient and modern hypotheses related to Exodus 2:10. The article concludes, in the Egyptian etymology of the name Moses is difficult to maintain, the debate around the names, presumably Semitic etymology, needs to be reopened. In other words, Schneider has a dog in this fight. He's already got a predetermined opinion here, and Michael S. Baron's work goes against Michael Schneider's, because Baron is basing his stuff all on the old school interpretation of the word Moses. So his stuff is all built off of the Egyptian and the Semitic language and putting those together. Schneider says, you know, I don't think that that's actually the word that we should be looking for here. I think we got something a little wrong, boys, better take another look. So, what's the most interesting about this to me? Well, two things, I should say. One, the number one criticism of this is really from somebody who is already off in their own little position here that's not mainstream. Number two, the criticism that he's making that sounds so sensible. Yeah, you don't want to take an unsubstantiated claim and run with it is exactly what he's doing here. Ah, this can't be right because of my unsubstantiated position. I'm going to run with it. Therefore, I'm going to reject Baron's claim. It's funny to me that every time I discuss archaeology, I seem to bump into this like hypocrisy that just seems to come out of these people's egos, even though they're espousing to be team science. Anyway, back to Michael S. Baron's claim, and I'll read from his paper, so again, you don't have to get my blue-collar speak. Inscriptions most likely written between the latter 12th and 13th dynasties, belonging to an Egyptian Western Semite population. Send my two scribes and priests under the yoke of an indentured servitude and slavery to the Pharaoh, one that intensified over time, worshipped El alongside those who followed Balak, with some presumably worshipping both. That is, until a fervent El contingent, at a somewhat later time, would foment an aggressive, violent purge of that cult in the midst and a mass departure from the locale. A movement possibly led by a singular figure, one whose name may be found in two of the inscriptions, M.S. Moshe, Hebrew for Moses. In short, Baron believes that there was a war between some of the slaves of the Egyptians, those that worshipped El and those that worshipped Baalat, and he believes that this may have been led by the biblical Moses and resulted in the Exodus. And what's really intriguing about this is the mines there at Sarabet El-Kadim, those are considered to have been worked by slaves, and that's not argued by any mainstream historian. The evidence is so robust, and that dovetails nicely with what we read in Exodus. I mean, it does talk about them being enslaved by the Egyptians. So, if his translations are accurate, this gets to be pretty doggone intriguing. This puts us in a position where we're looking at, well, potentially something that actually verifies parts of the Bible. And I don't mean the miracles, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that this means the Red Sea was parted, so don't run all to the extreme with this. At the other side of things, don't just say that because the Bible exists and has miracles in it, all the other historical parts of it are complete bullshit. It is quite possible that the Exodus is actually somewhat accurate historically. And if that's the case, Michael S. Baron has probably provided the most solid piece of evidence for that so far. And I'll put that evidence on the screen right here. Now, as you can see, he goes into detail and shows us exactly why he believes what he does in regards to the direct translations. So here, take a good look. Judge for yourself. And then take a look at this. He believes that one of those two inscriptions may have actually been made by Moses himself, and he has evidence for this too. The inscriptions were usually signed on the right-hand side, and the one that he translates as saying by Moses is signed on the right side of the inscription as well, which has profound implications given that he has identified several other inscriptions most likely made by the same author. And he goes in even further detail, talking about how the cults of Baalat had their temple destroyed at about that time, potentially even by fire, and how the cult of Baalat worshipped a calf, and that Moses was said to have destroyed a golden calf. And ultimately, as Baron puts it, while it is far too broad a subject for this paper, the Exodus narrative seems to have been based on a core element of genuine history being told as such a sacred history would have been told in that culture. Not as a secular work aspiring to objective history, as the world would not see until Herodotus, but primarily as a vehicle for moral and sacred teaching and anchoring nationalist identity. In other words, Exodus has a core element of historical fact, even though it has a bunch of miracles and stuff in it. And this is a hard pill to swallow for many Bible believers and skeptics alike. The skeptics say, the hardcore skeptics, I mean, science has been in this spot for a very long time. We're just disproving the Bible as a knee-jerk reaction. So to many hardcore skeptics, anything that could possibly say there's anything in the Bible that's accurate is just rejected out of hand. Just like to many hardcore believers, anything that possibly could say that the Bible isn't the perfect word of God gets rejected out of hand. Which could get really frustrating to the rest of us, right? Because we're trying to suss the truth here, and ideologues just get in the damn way. And so at the end of the day, in my opinion, what we have here is akin to with King Arthur or Lao Tse or something like that, where there's a mythical figure that's not to be thrown out, baby, with the bathwater just because some goofy stuff is attributed to them. You could even say the same thing about figures like Jesus or Muhammad. These guys they probably existed, probably didn't do all the stuff that is attributed to them. Call me crazy for taking this middle-of-the-road approach, but to me, this seems so much more sensible. And in this case, I mean, let's talk about Baron's claim a little bit and get off my opinion there. Well, back to my opinion, but on his stuff. Dude, this is probably the most robust alternate claim that I've ever looked at. This is so... I put the images on the screen. It's not that difficult to, compare two designs, right? This letter is that letter. Okay, so that's not too tricky. What's tricky is the context of it, okay? What's tricky is where they're going to argue about whether or not that has the same meaning 1,000 years later or 2,000 years later as it did back in those days. And that's a fair debate between scholars. But when you look at it, this does look like, man, this dovetails so well with everything. It's not like they have to make any sort of stretches. We know they had slaves in those mines. We know that there's inscriptions in those mines. We know that Exodus exists as a historical thing, quote unquote. And this puts it all together. Pretty interesting stuff. And I highly suggest you check out the paper down below. It's long. But, you know, if you're watching me ramble, you probably have a little bit of patience, right? If not, just take my word for it. It's really, really good. But before I go, I just wanted to announce the quest for the Ancient Civilizations Conference. It's going to be held in Scottsdale, Arizona this December 5th through 7th. I'm going to be there with Jimmy Corsetti and Mike Collins and Gary Buechler and Hugh Newman and so many other people. It's going to be great. You should come down there and check it out. I'll shake hands, yell at you, we'll drink a beer together, throw rocks at some locals or something. I don't know. We'll take an Uber in circles and yell at local. We're going to have fun one way or the other. If nothing else, I'll get on stage and talk about this kind of shenanigans, and you can see me in person and when I can't edit myself. And oh boy, I'm not as pretty when I'm uncut. All right, well, thank you very much. I'll talk to you guys later. We'll see you next time.